Christopher Hitchens died 2 years ago this December, and to remember my old friend, we're going to present a few excerpts from interviews with Christopher over the years. Christopher and I last spent a reasonable piece of time with each other on New Year's Day 2011. He had come to California and was clearly saying goodbye to his friends. We spent the afternoon with a bottle of whiskey, I'm not embarrassed to say, talking about everything we'd talked about over our long friendship. Politics, we disagreed about half of the time. Literature, we were always in agreement. His literary judgments, and he was extremely widely read, I always found flawless. And then it came to matters of religion, on which we disagreed completely. I believe Christopher was incorrect to argue that a man could only be free without God. At the same time, though, I granted that freedom, the individual independence of the mind and the spirit, was what always remained his central concern. Just as I was about to leave, somehow G.K. Chesterton, a writer we both admired, came up, and Christopher, astonishingly to me, recited Chesterton's long poem Lepanto by heart. The poem is about the great sea battle in 1571 in which Don Juan of Austria, Chesterton calls him Don John, in which Don Juan of Austria gathers the forces and defeats the Ottoman fleet, saving Christendom. Strong gongs groaning as the guns boom far, Don John of Austria is going to war. Torchlight crimson on the copper kettle drums, then the tuckets, then the trumpets, then the cannon, and he comes, Don John laughing in the brave beard curled, spurning of his stirrups like the thrones of all the world, holding his head up for a flag of all the free, Don John of Austria is riding to the sea. Christopher Hitchens, knight and troubadour who so loved going to the wars, and who held his head up for a flag of all the free. And now a few excerpts of interviews with Christopher Hitchens, during which I'm sure you will see why his many friends, 2 years later, still miss him.
I was a dedicated Marxist. I was a member of an organization that was actually anti-Castroite organization. If you're really interested in my personal history, you have to get some sectarian minutiae in. It was a Luxembourgist Trotskyist organization, and we sent a delegation of people to see whether or not the Cuban Revolution was, as advertised, a break with the Soviet model, a new start, and all of that. And this was remembered shortly after the death of the much controverted Ernesto Che Guevara. And it was a very interesting time to be there, because I was there during the invasion of Czechoslovakia, which was the point at which it became evident that Castroism was not going to live up to the advertised hopes.
You were how old, Christopher?
I was then 19.
19. And you were in Oxford at that time?
I was the end of my first year in Oxford. Yes.
Right. Now, what I'm interested in is to the extent to which your thinking was in some way representative of the thinking of your generation. That is to say, those protesters in Chicago, those people planting beans in Cuba, were you an outlier? Were you especially ideological? Or was there a hard ideological core?
But we felt in our little corner of the left that the great thing about 1968 was exactly that both of the Cold War camps were undergoing a convulsion, and our great hope was, which was disappointed, was for a convergence between those two things.
Your great hope as a member of this small organization, the Trotskyite organization, or
yes.
Your great hope, your generation's great hope?
Well, I think this was held in common by a lot of people who were completely new to politics and quite naive about it.
The war in Vietnam. You oppose it on moral and ideological grounds as aggressive and imperialist.
Yes.
Now, so my question is, you really believed that? You thought that the United States was the United States was the offending party?
I would affirm it now. In fact, with greater knowledge and infinitely larger depth of evidence to draw upon, yes.
That the Chinese, the Soviets, supplying the North Vietnamese were the good guys in this one.
I think the hardest thing probably to get people to remember now, even though they must remember it at the time, or should, is that the official reason given for intervention in Vietnam. Well, there were several, and they kept changing, but one of them was that it was to stop Chinese expansionism into the Indochinese Peninsula. That's now considered so ridiculous, and it's so self-evidently untrue, that it's hard to remember that that was one of the official alibis.
All right. What did you make of the civil rights movement?
Well, I couldn't phrase it better than you did. I mean, it seemed to me that it was the summa, really, especially Dr. King's leadership, of what it was to take part in the movement that we called the 60s. And I think probably the crucial moment for me, and I remember it very well, was when Dr. King, in his address at Riverside Church, said that despite enormous lectures from the black establishment and the white liberal establishment too, he was no longer going to remain silent about the Vietnam War because, and here's my third point about that war, as well as about the movement, all the energy that should have gone to the repair of legal racism and poverty in the South, legally enforceable poverty and racism and so on, was going on the war. I mean, Johnson immolated his great society for that war. And the connection between the two seemed so strong and self-evident as to be, well, with me still.
Lyndon Johnson broke his hump getting the civil rights bill
exactly.
through Congress.
No, but it broke his hump doing that precisely, and broke his heart and other bits of his anatomy and other people's as well in Indochina, and destroyed what had been going to be the advertised great society. Now, we talk about lawlessness and the rest of it,
right.
The 60s, the contempt for law. What we only suspected then has been amply demonstrated since, that there was really quite high-level collusion with crime and disorder and subversion and provocation by those who were sworn to uphold it.
By J. Edgar Hoover, Bobby Kennedy listening.
Yes, absolutely. By bugging, by planting agent provocateur, by stirring up incidents of violence, by circulating false racist propaganda. And in Mississippi, all the files have now just been published of how the state authorities themselves colluded in murder and kidnapping and lynching.
So Bush is making a terrible mistake.
A terrible mistake, yeah. Sectarianism cannot be countenanced. Religious sectarianism is the worst poison that can ever affect society. We are helping to empower it at the center, even as we are, I will say, helping to defeat it on the periphery. But this is a contradiction that can't go on for very much longer. I don't believe the president understands it for a second.
President Bush, once again, here's his one of the rationales he puts forward for remaining in Iraq. We fight for the possibility that decent men and women across the broader Middle East can realize their destiny and raise up societies based on freedom and justice and personal dignity, close quote. How do you respond to that?
Well, initially, after the liberation of Baghdad in the first place, liberation of Iraq in the first place, there were very positive responses from the people of Lebanon, for example, who voted in a majority to get rid of Syrian occupation and voted into power something like a multi-confessional democratic coalition. There's since been a terrible counterstroke to that from Hezbollah and its Syrian and Iranian backers. Nonetheless, it was an example worth having. Mm-hmm. Started a very lively argument about democratization and reform in Egypt, the crucial country in the region, mm-hmm. And even in Saudi Arabia.
Egypt is crucial, why? Because it's so big? 60 million
yes.
people?
Yes. Someone once said, I forget who it was now, said that Egypt is the only real country in the Middle East, the only real nation. All the rest are just tribes with flags. It's an ancient, brilliant civilization. Right. Large population, it's the crossroads country.
The Lower Nile,
it's got real thickness and depth.
Got it, all right.
By the way, you see, I mean, just on the Clinton thing, if I may.
Yes.
I mean, Clinton becomes president. He's the first man to take the oath of office after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. I mean, it's all over. He's got a wonderful opportunity to redo foreign policy, of which he makes almost nothing. And by the way, he said he would help the Bosnians during the election campaign. He let that run for 2 years. He had to intervene when it was nearly a disaster. Nothing will ever efface the shame of what he refused to do, even given advice of what was going to happen in Rwanda. I might add here that most of the Senate and Congressional Republican Party was opposed to the rescue operation in Bosnia,
yes.
as it was in Kosovo.
Yes,
that
indeed.
Deserves to be said, I think.
Right.
So it was absolutely in favor of doing nothing about Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And a large chunk of the right wing still think that the war on terror is a war for Israel or a war for liberalism right. or something that America should stay out of. So this is not a left-right question. I think this is more than just instinct on my part. The reaction of a lot of Democrats and liberals to the September 11th events was obviously in common with everyone else. Revulsion, disgust, hatred, and so on.
Right.
But when they considered it politically, I think a lot of them couldn't say this, but they thought, that's the end of our agenda for a little while. We're not going to be talking very much about welfare and gay marriage and stuff. We're going to be living in law and order times now. And the instinct is to think, well, that must favor the right wing. Surely that creates a climate for the conservatives, and law and order and warfare and mobilization and so forth. In fact, the Second World War probably was a tremendous asset to the Democratic left, presumably why the right was so opposed to going into it, because they know there's a relationship between social mobilization and warfare. But the left is too dumb to see this in this case. And then some of them are crackpotted enough to think that if it comes out like that, maybe it was all fixed to come out like this.
Oh, that really is crackpot.
Well, you get a cultural hero made out of someone like Michael Moore, who's willing to deal in that kind of talk, more than willing to deal with it. And a man who, in my opinion, would have made a perfectly good brown shirt. Does make a perfectly good brown shirt. Marxism takes its point of departure from the study of real forces of production, conflict between forces and relations of production, study of capitalism, this kind of thing. Other people like to look for hidden financial conspiracies and so forth. That's the opposite of socialism.
For the Wall Street Journal and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.